Hello and welcome to this week's Horror Weekly, Horror Movies Worth Fighting For. We asked 500,000 horror fans online to name movies they loved but that had been treated harshly by critics or forgotten by fans, and we're here with their answers and ours. Now, when I'm talking about myself or fellow horror fans defending the horror movies they love or think deserve more attention, I'm not necessarily thinking about, in that defense, changing anyone's mind. I mean, sure, that could happen, but other things could happen too. Like, for example, I recently read an interesting post on Reddit defending the director's cut of The Lawnmower Man. If you don't know what The Lawnmower Man is, it's a 1992 science fiction horror film theoretically based on a Stephen King short story, although it absolutely is not. And the Reddit post by the aptly named Annoying Captcha said, "The Lawnmower Man director's cut is Pierce Brosnan's magnum opus. It has a cybernetically enhanced monkey. It has the nootropic singularity. It has virtual reality headsets and gyroscopes. It has the guy that plays Hank in Breaking Bad. This movie was low-key influential and a lot of other random shit, and very few have seen it. The second episode of Rick and Morty is a direct reference to it. It is the most what-the-fuck sci-fi horror movie ever made. Honorable mention, though, goes to Jason X and Leprechaun 4 because, well, space and top-tier schlock." Now, I remember not thinking very much of The Lawnmower Man when I first saw it, although randomly, I met one of the actors in it, Jenny Wright, in the most absolutely random way possible. And she was awesome in person, so I always had like this weird soft spot for this movie, even though I'd never gotten into it. So after reading Annoying Captcha's defense, since it's been years, I went back and watched the director's cut on Tubi, and I still found it pretty hard to get through, and I found it very, very ridiculous in a lot of places. But I did like it more than I remembered. I did have an absolute blast watching it, and I kind of loved the ending. So technically, did Annoying Captcha's defense of The Lawnmower Man change my mind? Not really. I mean, marginally, I guess. If The Lawnmower Man was like on trial in a court of law as a movie, and I was a juror that had thought it was guilty, after Annoying Captcha's defense, and after re-examining the evidence, so to speak, by rewatching it, I still vote guilty. But did Annoying Captcha's defense give me a fun 90 minutes of movie watching I wouldn't have had otherwise? Yes. Did Annoying Captcha's defense make me aware of things I wasn't aware of before and get me to rewatch Rick and Morty episode 2, for example? Yes. Did I discover through some curious searching that there are serious academics writing ultra-serious papers, like with titles The Lawnmower Man Effect, which they hilariously abbreviate all throughout the paper as LME? And is that absolutely amazing? Yes. So I kind of think of this when I think of horror fans discussing or debating the genre, whether it's in our community or elsewhere. Changing someone's mind is way less important than just adding something valuable or unique or interesting or fun to the discussion. So that's the spirit I'm going into this Fight for Your Movies episode with. If you thought George Romero's Land of the Dead was unwatchable trash when you first saw it, and yes, that's an actual comment from a post we recently did about Land of the Dead on the Horror Weekly Facebook page, and you still think it's unwatchable trash after I talk about it here for 5 minutes, that's just fine with me. Hopefully, all that happened was I sprinkled a little, I don't know, let's call it Lawnmower Man effect over the movies I'm going to defend here. So let's get a little of that LME action going and talk about Land of the Dead, the unrated version. I'm recording this particular episode right after the record-setting box office opening weekend of Barbenheimer. And my favorite stat to come out of this weekend is that Thor Love and Thunder somehow cost more to make than Barbie and Oppenheimer combined. And this seems to be a massive signal from the theater-going audience that they're a little tired of sequels. Like, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning got crushed in its second week, absolutely steamrolled by the pink and black machine. And this makes sense because sequels are usually uncreative or try hard or both. I mean, look at both Friday the 13th, 2009 and Halloween 2018. Now, there are some things I like about each of those movies in their own way. Halloween 2018 is basically The Force Awakens of the Halloween franchise. Basically a remake of the first movie with a lot of trauma thrown in and Michael Myers disappearing into flames instead of disappearing into the night. Friday the 13th, 2009 is an exercise in, what if you hate everyone that Jason kills in the movie? But the main things that these movies get sort of right is they do a pretty good job of making Jason and Michael scary again and making Jason and Michael look good cinematically again. But these movies are not exercises in creativity. They are homages. They are trying to recapture the feeling you once had way back in the day when you saw these names and these titles rolling in the opening and closing credits. Sequels like Jason X and Halloween Resurrection, whether you like them or not, seem to have a sort of weird amnesia about what franchise they even came from, or like where it all started in the first place. George Romero's Land of the Dead isn't like any of that at all. All his first four Dead movies, they're like an animal that you passed every once in a while when you were hiking. Each year you pass that animal, it's evolving, it's getting weirder, it has this nasty glint in its eye, but it's progressing, it's growing into something. Dawn of the Dead showed us that zombies had vague memories, like they used to shop at malls in their life before. Day of the Dead showed us zombies could be trained, they were developing some kind of like low order or proto-intelligence. Land of the Dead shows us they will evolve even without training, because it turns out the harshness of just existing in this world is the training. They will learn to communicate a bit. They will learn to use tools a bit. And they will start to form their own little tribes. A problem with Land of the Dead might be Romero made the zombies in that movie evolve too quickly inside the boundaries of just one movie. But, I mean, at that point, he was getting older, and you can hardly blame him for trying to speed things up a bit, I guess. Meanwhile, in Land of the Dead, human society has devolved. I mean, humanity was almost entirely wiped out, and now here we are, and we didn't learn anything from that experience, apparently. Now that society is starting to reassemble itself, of course, we immediately reformed into haves and have-nots. We sheltered, of course, in a former mall and turned it into Fiddler's Green. We're still as much a danger to ourselves as the zombies are, so humanity's always fighting a two-front war still. A war against the shambling enemy outside and the backstabbing enemy within. So Romero evolved his story in the smartest and most authentic way. Granted, none of the people in Land of the Dead are as interesting as the people in the previous three Dead movies. But would you look at that? The zombies in Land are more interesting than any of the zombies in the past ones, except Bud. But here in Land, we have so many more of them. Now it's like a scale balancing itself because you put a weight on it. The interest level for zombies versus humans in Land is 50-50. I see Night of the Living Dead through Land of the Dead as a tetralogy, and I think if Romero had continued where Land was headed, then two movies later he would have had zombies being the heroes and humans being barely distinguishable from each other. It would have been like a photo negative of Night of the Living Dead. Almost all my memories thinking back while I'm recording this of Land are haunting shots of the zombies, hypnotized by sky flowers, which are the greatly renamed fireworks in this movie, but then not so hypnotized. And that slow sequence where they start learning to use tools, where they're like dragging their arms along the ground and making groaning sounds and picking up cleavers and guns and hammers. I remember the astonishing zombie jump scare scene. Now, when I say zombie jump scare scene, you're thinking, if you haven't seen the movie, that this is a zombie popping out and scaring you, the audience. But no, this is a jump scare on the zombies. There's this moment where they finally learn how to hack through this barrier and they punch a hole through it with an axe. And as Big Daddy kind of, he's the leader of the zombies. He's a former gas station attendant that we met at the beginning of the movie. And he's clearly the one that's evolved the most. Think of him as kind of like Caesar from the Dawn of the Planet Apes and on. So Big Daddy and his followers peer through this hole they made in the barrier, and they get like this swinging upside down zombie body that pops right into view, and they flinch. And they like they make that Frankenstein sound, like they're not they don't react to jump scares the way humans would, but they definitely have some kind of reaction. That's right. It's I don't know of another zombie jump scare where the jump scare was perpetrated on the zombies. But the reason this body is hanging upside down is because as they look further out into the expanse through the hole they made, they see a bunch of zombies hung upside down with bullseyes painted on them or wrapped around them, targets placed on them. And this is basically a demented shooting range for the humans. And this enrages Big Daddy and his friends. I also remember Tom Savini and Greg Nicotero themselves roaming around the movie as stenches, which is always great to see. And more than anything, I remember my two favorite moments from Land of the Dead. One, it's Big Daddy leading his hesitant horde across, or underneath, really, the river separating him from his nemesis. Because it's not him versus us. In Land of the Dead, it's him versus Fiddler's Green. That's what Big Daddy keeps staring at throughout the movie. Because he knows in his unbeating heart that his people's zombies, whatever we're calling them, their tormentors are coming from that glowing building rising up way far away in the sky. And the shot of him and the zombies emerging out of the water to go get that building, it's reminds me very much of one of my favorite horror films of all time, Carnival of Souls. But just the moonlit night, the reflections coming off the skyscraper onto the water from far away, the rotting and now drenched zombies emerging from the river, it's just such a beautiful sequence. And my other favorite moment is when Big Daddy does away with a key villain in the movie via gasoline. Because that was his job in his past life. That's where he comes from. He's come full circle, and he's using his once human skill sets to show he understands the assignment now. This is the new job he trained for his whole life and has been training for his whole death, too. I remember the vehicle Dead Reckoning from this movie, which is just, I mean, even the vehicles in Romero's movies are evolving. This is the Green Goblin truck of survivalist machines that the humans make. This thing can shoot rockets and bullets and fireworks. And I remember the amazing moment when Simon Baker, who plays our protagonist in the movie, spots Big Daddy taking his horde across a bridge in the dead of night and heading off to bloodier pastures. And he doesn't allow Dead Reckoning's gunners to shoot the zombies, even though the line he says when he doesn't let them shoot is cool. He says something like, they're just headed, you know, to find somewhere to be just like we are, or something like that. It's not the line that's magic here. It's the look. It's the look these two characters give each other. This spectral, haunting, nonverbal exchange between two exhausted leaders of their packs. And Romero, defiant to the end, literally mocks the idea of easy entertainment on his way out of this movie, firing Dead Reckoning's useless fireworks into the sky and sending a group of people off on an impossible quest to be alone and be a society at the same time. Now, I don't think Land of the Dead is perfect, and it's a tightrope act. It's hard to transition the audience's interest from the human set of characters to the zombie set of characters. And by making the human set of characters a little more forgettable, even though, I liked Simon Baker's arc. I loved his sidekick, Charlie. I liked there was a strangely affecting sequence where they're using Dead Reckoning to try to save a group of humans, and they think they failed, and then a bunch of humans emerge from the shadows still alive, and it packed a punch. I mean, Dennis Hopper's running around chewing scenery, which is just, I mean, who's ever going to say no to that? I thought John Leguizamo was pretty great as kind of like a rogue element unto himself. And the mayhem and gore in here is pretty legitimate in most of the cases. So is Land of the Dead as good as the first three Dead movies? No. But that's the thing. In the hands of any other director, this would have been an outright masterpiece. And even though it's not quite up to the first three, it's a mini masterpiece in itself. Now, the next movie I want to fight for here is 2020's Wolf of Snow Hollow. If you haven't seen Snow Hollow, it's an absolutely ravishing looking werewolf movie written and directed by Jim Cummings. Unfortunately, it seems like it was a disaster box office wise. It only made $266,000 off a $2 million budget. And I saw a lot of critics whose basic thesis was it didn't live up to Jim Cummings' first movie, so it was a letdown. If you haven't seen Snow Hollow, the synopsis is a stressed out police officer struggles not to give in to the paranoia that grips his small mountain town as bodies turn up after each full moon. The movie was dedicated to the great Robert Forster, and this was his last role. Now, I'm not going to spoil the end of this movie, but I am going to spoil kind of into the middle section. So if that kind of thing bothers you, then go watch this great movie and come back. So the one thing I want to talk about here first is the kill sequences in Wolf of Snow Hollow are spectacular. The opening one is really good with a really evocative shot of like a full moon in the sky reflected down into a huge puddle of blood, which is very memorable. The actors here really sell this. As a matter of fact, I thought they were kind of throwaway characters to introduce us to the werewolf, but the boyfriend from this opening sequence comes back later in the movie and does a really effective job. He's kind of playing like it's almost like the vibe that Robert Downey Jr.'s character gave me in Zodiac. He's just kind of broken from the experience that he's been through. So the opening death is a strong sequence, but the second werewolf attack is a masterpiece in its own right. I remember it was one visual from this attack in the trailer that got me interested in watching this movie in the first place. Okay, let me set the scene for you here, because this sequence might be my favorite 3 minutes in 2020's horror so far. First of all, I love the setting of Snow Hollow. Think 30 Days of Night crossed with Twin Peaks. It's just a small town used to petty crimes and the occasional tourist incident. But the sequence starts with us meeting a snowboarding instructor, and she's really cool. She's teaching a group, and one of the people is like talking back to her, and she shuts them down beautifully in a really smart but like non-confrontational, diplomatic, funny way. And that's one thing that's really interesting about Snow Hollow is all of these characters seem out of their depth but also smart at the same time. The first couple, the boyfriend who is traumatized for life after the incident, when we first met him earlier in the movie, he was confronting someone for using a slur publicly because he was defending his brother. And it was a good moment of him showing that he's brave. These aren't just like throwaway characters that are easy to dispose of to put into like sleeping bags and bash against trees, which makes the fact that they're still all getting plowed down mean that the villain is that much more formidable. But we follow this snowboarding instructor through a few, very brief scene of her like instructing a group, bringing them to the bottom of a hill, and then like having lunch with them afterwards. And then there's this amazing moment while she's just happily talking to them where she looks up looks directly at the camera and gets like this real profound sense of unease on her face. And she's clearly seeing someone. And I still, having seen this movie multiple times now, cannot make up my mind about whether she's seeing a threat or she's seeing this possibly semi-abusive ex, sort of ex-boyfriend that she's going to go, unfortunately, try to see later. And I love that it's ambiguous, or at least it's ambiguous to me. If you watch the movie and it's super clear to you, please message me at the Horror Weekly Facebook page or on the Threads page and let me know what you think of it, because I've never been able to figure it out. But she packs up her things and goes off to her van, which is parked, of course, alone in a parking lot or in the road into the parking lot. I don't know how these small town mountain skiing lodge places work. All the lights are clicking off all around her, and she's changing shoes so that she can drive. And as she's like sitting there outside her van and with the full moon looming above, just beautiful shots, we start to hear growling and howling, and then there's a werewolf attack. And what's interesting here is it's also intercut with a time jump wise, Tarantino-esque wise, with a scene of the sheriff the next morning having a talk with his ex-wife. They're trying to make arrangements for the daughter, and he's about to be brought the news of the killing that we're witnessing now. So we're jumping back and forth, which is strangely effective for this attack sequence. And then after we jump back in time to the finish the attack, it's so gorgeous. It's so gorgeously shot and threatening. And the werewolf assault sounds massive. It looks horrendous, but the snowboard instructor is fighting back. She's not going down without a struggle. And she goes to like brace herself after she's been knocked down and realizes she's missing half an arm. The werewolf has lopped it off, and she sees it, and she's going into shock, and she's still panicking with a little fight left in her. And the camera tracks back to this wide shot, and it shows the werewolf, which is at this point crouching, stand up to its full height, drop the half of arm that it's holding, and look over at her. And it's one of the most threatening, like, Hammer films in the 2020s looking thing I've seen ever. And then we cut away and we know she's done for, but it's confirmed for us when the deputy charges into the diner and tells the sheriff, his name is John, that you got to come right away. And he looks up and he's like, why? And then he sees the deputy's face and he just goes, oh. And again, it's a thing that I really love about this movie, is that it's not over-explaining things. That fact that he knew what was happening from that single look, that it didn't have to be all exposition, it's like sketched in. It's like horror movie by haiku. And I think these next moments are what makes this whole sequence next level. Because as glorious as all that I just described was, we go to the crime scene and the camera's like spinning slowly and then faster around the sheriff as he's trying to get a grip on the crime scene itself, keep the media out, answer questions, give directions to the staff, to the forensics team. And you can tell that it's all spinning out of control, that they are way out of their league. And I'm basically so used to two effects in horror or thriller movies. One is the police show up on scene and they're like super competent and heroic, like Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt in Seven style. Or they're completely incompetent, like a couple cops bumbling in Plan 9 from Outer Space style. And in the first case, you want the police to just go all Clarice Starling on the place and figure everything out. And in the second case, you know they're doomed from the start, but you sort of don't care that they're doomed because they're so fucking incompetent. In this case, you're just anxious for the police force because they're trying their asses off to solve this thing and to figure out what's happening, and they just can't do it, and it's getting worse and worse for them. It's like the opposite feeling that I get from watching David Fincher's Zodiac, where you know that the killer's one step ahead of the detectives for a lot of the time, but you do feel like they're getting closer and closer to following that thread and figuring it out. In this one, that spinning camera really represents the fact that these people are all going to get thrown off the roller coaster really soon. It's just beautiful, beautiful, and anxiety-inducing stuff. The relationships that run between John, the sheriff in this movie, and his father. Actually, I keep calling John the sheriff, and he's the de facto sheriff, but his dad, Robert Forster, is the technical sheriff in the movie, but he's not really doing anything. He's semi-retired at this point. But the relationship between him and his dad, trying to protect him from the stresses of police work because he has a weak heart, and the relationship between him and his basically his second in command, a detective named Julia, played by Ricky Lindholm, who is fantastic in the role. And the relationship between John and his daughter, even though that's the weakest of the three relationships, but I guess that makes sense because he's so consumed by his job. And let's face it, just not that great a father. But the detective, Julia, is bringing real Frances McDormand Fargo energy to this, but like in her own non-derivative, very distinctive way. It's really a wonderful performance. There's a great moment when the police force kind of gathers in a room to brainstorm and figure out, are they dealing with a serial killer? Then they start joking around, that's a werewolf, haha, no one believes in werewolves. And she kind of like gets into the joking with them, and then they start laughing harder. And then she says, like, under her breath, the way Richard Dreyfuss in Jaws said, haha, they're all going to die. She does this moment where they're all laughing, and then she's like, ah, everyone laughs until they see the crime scene photos. And then she busts out these incredibly gory pictures of the victim. And again, she makes eye contact with the camera. Like, she's also talking to us, the audience, because I was definitely laughing with the group at the point. And then those pictures went down, and then she looked at me, and it was like I was in the room with them. And that's another thing this movie does really, really well. It's focusing on the faces of the characters a lot. The cameras are really closing in on the characters' faces, showing their reactions. Sometimes we're not seeing what they're seeing, but we realize how bad it is from just the looks on their faces. The movie itself seems obsessed with faces. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite lines from the movie is that boyfriend we're talking about from the beginning scene. He tells the cops later when they come to, ask him questions at the end when they walk away, because this werewolf, the death of his girlfriend was so grisly at the hands of this werewolf. He tells the cops, when you get this guy, because he doesn't know it's a werewolf at this point, is when you get this guy, don't arrest him. Shoot him until you can see the ground through his face. And it's the little things with this movie, like really well-written lines like that, or tiny moments. Like there's a great time where John and Julia are driving semi-defeated because they can't catch their serial killer werewolf, and they're driving, and all of a sudden their car gets struck by something, and it turns out it's a beer bottle. And John jumps out gun drawn because he doesn't know what it was. And then Julia's like, someone threw a beer bottle at us. And he's like, who would throw a beer bottle at a cop car? And then the camera pans up and you just see this mountainous, bleak, cold landscape. And you realize you all live in a place that is just, it's either going to draw people who are very independent and very possibly weird, or it's going to make people weird. But it's definitely like a place where things can get out of, you know, bonds really quickly. And they're feeling it. The town is turning on the police all the time during the course of the movie, telling them, why haven't you caught this person yet? Like, they're very hostile. And I like that a lot. You get a real sense of community here. It's not like you don't get a sense of community at Crystal Lake. I mean, you get a sense of community in the camp, but Crystal Lake proper. This place feels like a functioning, well, dysfunctional, actual tiny city. Now, this werewolf is ruthless, and the victims, this movie isn't pulling punches. There are victims of all ages, victims that you wouldn't expect if you're used to like PG-13 horror movies. But the tone of the movie is really odd. It actually kind of reminded me, it was like Heathers meets Silver Bullet somehow. Something about the tone of this thing felt jagged and a little off, which I really ended up liking. And the villain of this movie, good God, people. The villain of this movie gave me true Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs vibes at some point, but also just, I don't want to say darker, but like almost more Grimm's Fairy Tales-ish. There's a visual at the end of this movie that I can't fully explain without going full spoiler mode, but it's a shot where someone stands up and they're kind of framed in a door frame. And it felt like something Bram Stoker came back from the grave and wrote for a moment. There was just voltage coming off the screen and between the two characters. Just glorious stuff. And look, the movie isn't perfect. If it was perfect, I wouldn't be here defending it. If it was universally beloved, there'd be no one fighting, having to fight for it. All I can tell you is that for me, it's a grower. It's one of those movies that I like better and better each time I watch it, which is a particularly cool thing for a movie to pull off if it's got twists, if it's kind of like a horror whodunit. A lot of time, once the twist is revealed, it takes a lot of the punch out of the movie. But in this case, I've just loved it more and more with each viewing. The werewolf is truly sinister, but like in a certain moment towards the end, in the way that it's shot, also kind of pitiful, which is a really interesting thing. It's something that dates all the way back to Wolfman with Lon Chaney Jr., where there's pathos to these werewolves. They're not just like, you know, there's nothing pitiful or pathetic about the vampires in 30 Days of Night. They're ferocious and scary until they're completely defeated. But it's weird. It's kind of summed up by that sound of a wolf's the howling of a wolf. It's sometimes it can just sound nothing but eerie and threatening, but sometimes it sounds lonely and pained. And it's always just great to see Robert Forster, who I fell in love with in Jackie Brown and who was magnificent in Twin Peaks: The Return and did a million other things. So when you put all that together, it makes Wolf of Snow Hollow one of my favorite horror movies of the 2020s so far. Now, we did throw this question to the community, and when we asked them, what horror movies do you fight for, the two top vote getters were 13 Ghosts, and one of the best comments in the voting under that was a response to Ashley, who started off the voting. And the response was from Jenny LG, and she said, "Ashley, I was looking for someone who said 13 Ghosts. I loved this. My 25-year-old stepdaughter, when she was 13, loved this, and now my 14-year-old daughter loves it. So three generations watched and enjoyed it," which is really cool. Joe said, "I feel this one has finally grown into the classic it deserves to be. Yeah, I remember the bad reviews when it first came out, but I also remembered a theater full of happy people enjoying it greatly." And the other top vote getter was Event Horizon. Scott Smith said, "It bombed at the box office and had very mixed reviews, but I love the movie and its cross of space horror and Hellraiser-like ideas. I own it and have watched it several times. It has a perfect pace and ominous tone, in my opinion." Yes, Scott, a lot of people agreed with your opinion because it was high up in the voting. There were a bunch of people fighting for Killer Clowns from Outer Space. There was a pretty big group fighting for Halloween 3, although I think that fight was won years ago. There was a group of people fighting for the Suspiria remake. And then quite a few sequels people were fighting for. Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection. The Fright Night 2 got a lot of love, along with the Fright Night remake. There was a good amount of voting, and I think this was all steered by a single comment in this case, because sometimes that happens. Sometimes someone just says something so eloquent or interesting when they start the vote that they get votes as much for their comment or statement as the movie, which is one of the things I love about our community and the page. So Dave Whitehead said this about The Prophecy. He said, "I was obsessed with and still love The Prophecy. The only part of it that garnered any significant praise was Christopher Walken's turn as Gabriel. And while he plays all the best lines dripping with contempt, it was the idea of a literalist reading of angels that held me spellbound. Flawed and awful, weak and narrow, face down by faith at the end, it literally changed my worldview of sex of the organized religions." Amazing. "It was good to see a lot of people fighting for Crimson Peak and also for the Serpent and the Rainbow. And I can't leave this off without mentioning the voting for John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness, which is one of my favorite Carpenter movies. I'll tell you, it's just great to see all you horror warriors out there fighting for the things that you love." Now, before we wrap up for the week, there are a couple itches I want to scratch. The first one is, I came to horror when I was really young through reading first, actually, which I know is kind of weird, even before watching movies and TV. I was reading stuff like Edgar Allan Poe and a lot of horror anthologies and stuff from the classics. I remember reading Dracula's Guest, which is like that short beginning chapter of Bram Stoker's Dracula, really early. And I'm just really passionate about the reading of it all. And this is my fault. Like, it's because I've neglected it for lack of time. But there is a Horror Weekly book club. It's mainly centered in a Facebook group called the Horror Weekly Book Club. Real creative name. But I want to start bringing it a little more to the podcast and other places, just because there are a lot of times where I see great discussions going on and people are looking for things to read or looking to find people to talk to about the exciting stuff they've read. And I really want to encourage that here. So there may pop in some book recommendations from what I'm reading or what is getting recommended through the community. And hopefully I'll keep it short and try not to have it be annoying, because I know this has mainly been a movie and TV podcast for the 30-odd episodes we've done. But I just love it so much. What am I going to do? I'm helpless. So this isn't a book recommendation so much, but there is a publisher named Valancourt Books. And they do absolutely phenomenal work. I am not being paid for this. I'm just super passionate about what they do because I'm a book cover lover too. So like when you really get the art of the book cover right, and they if they have great lead-in introductions, which they always do, and you find interesting works to publish. So they're kind of like the Criterion Collection, but for books. So they're finding old classics or forgotten classics and bringing them back with the occasional modern thing thrown in. But it's kind of like they kind of partnered with the Paperbacks from Hell situation that Grady Hendrix started, which is also phenomenal. And they've reissued some of the quote unquote paperbacks from Hell in brand new editions that are absolutely glorious. But they have really interesting stuff. I got a sci-fi horror novel called The Black Cloud, written by Fred Hoyle, who wrote like The Rules of Poker, like, I don't know, 100 years ago or however old he was or old this thing was. He's one of the first scientific popularizers of the concept of the Big Bang. Who knew he was over here writing horror novels as well? But sadly, I get the sense from this company that they're always financially on the ropes, which sucks for them, but like they're always running like flash deals and you know, $1.99 ebooks and like free shipping stuff and etc. So if you love good quality throwback horror literature, Valancourt Books is a great find. And I also really love reading nonfiction about horror. So there is a company, I don't even know if it's a company, I don't know what the hell it is, to be honest with you. There's a series of books called Devil's Advocates, and they do really cool behind-the-scenes making of It's like a good making of documentary, like Crystal Lake Memories or Never Sleep Again, for movies. So they did a really great one on The Descent that I picked up recently. I've read other great ones. They did a really good one on Suspiria. They're also really interesting. And my favorite thing that I've read this year so far is, it's not from this year, it's just new to me, but it's a book called Reflections. It's an oral history of Twin Peaks. It's assembled by Brad Dukes. It has the most beautiful cover I could imagine. But just to hear in the oral history form, the passion and the creativity and the force of ideas that were being put, channeled into the making of that show is a glory to read. And the other thing that needs to be said here is just some deep and grateful thank yous. It's been amazing to watch. We were talking about the subscriber group last week's episode. And the idea behind this is because the community has grown so large and I miss so much for lack of time, we wanted to put together a smaller, close-knit group that helps make this podcast together in a more direct way, more direct than just answering the questions on the page. So actually having dialogue with me and, you know, giving me suggestions and ideas and just like the fun stuff too, like what are we watching tonight and hanging out. And that group gained a bunch of people. So to Samantha and John and Timothy and Cindy, and also to R.C. Martin, who's been holding down the fort over there for a long time now, I just want to say a huge thank you. And this group has already helped me kind of shape a couple episodes to come in idea form. And if you want to join there, I will put the link in the show notes. This podcast is really supposed to be a collaborative thing. It's funny. Between last week and now, we got a bunch of positive reviews. So thank you for that, too. I'll talk about that real brief in a second. But there was a negative review. It's always one in the week. We're trying to get to that 4.8 rating on Spotify. We're at 4.7 out of 5. And we're so close to getting 4.8. And I keep seeing people leave good ratings. And then there's always one, right? But there was a negative review and it said, this podcast desperately needs a co-host. So here's the thing. I kind of assumed that when I launched this myself, right? Like, then I realized the more I did it, that we're all co-hosting this damn thing together. That's what the pages are for. That's why we ask so many questions there. That's why there's so much voting and so many thousands of comments and just interesting things being said there all the time. Like, I don't need a co-host anymore, I think, because we're all co-hosting. That's why I'm reading so much of what's being said there. I'm actually really interested in getting some audio clips from people, you know, answering the questions from the page or just sharing horror memories or things they love or insights they have, which I would love. I mean, I'm totally open to. I'm not hugely tech savvy, so editing a bunch of stuff in is like, I'm also a perfectionist, so I don't want it to sound bad. So it's, you know, but I'd love to try it. But anyway, I very rarely say a reviewer is wrong. But that reviewer, I might have thought they were right a year ago. I think they're wrong now. We don't need a co-host anymore because you're all co-hosting this thing with me. I also want to give a very excited shout out to Oliver Oddball over on Apple. He gave a 5-star review on Apple. And I've been so focused on the Spotify thing, I didn't realize that our podcast was rated 4.6, even lower on Apple. And then it jumped to 4.7. It was because of this 5-star review put us over the top. And it came along with some really nice comments. It's too embarrassing for me to read them all out loud. But the headline was great, thought-provoking podcast. I appreciate that. There was an interesting thing in the middle of the review that said, the best way I can describe this is it's a horror genre analysis podcast, but without being overly pretentious, judgmental, or preachy. God, I hope it's that. I hope I can live up to that because that's exactly what I was kind of trying to make it. So, Oliver, thank you so much for getting it. And shout out to your Desert Island band, Talking Heads. Psycho Killer. I love it. And he ended the review with "Keep up the great work," which was really appreciated. It's, you know, this was a harder than normal episode to record for reasons I don't want to get into. But it's that kind of feedback that makes it almost feel effortless even when it gets hard. So thank you so much. And also thank you to everyone who voted, the hundreds and hundreds of comments about the movies you're going to defend and the things you're fighting for. That's what this podcast is for. All right, we're done here. If you're interested in the subscriber group, I'll link it in the show notes. And that's it. So until next Wednesday, have a great horror week.